Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We did definitely get another read that showed strength in the U.S. labor market. Initial applications for U.S. unemployment benefits falling for the first time in 3 weeks, suggesting employers are still largely holding on, Tim, to their workers.
Continuing claims, a proxy for the number of people receiving unemployment benefits, dropped to 1.87 million in the week that ended on January 27th. Meantime, in a Bloomberg exclusive, a voting member of the Fed says, slow your roll, everyone. Policymakers have time to be patient about the timing of rate cuts, pointing to that strong labor market and continued disinflation.
All right, maybe he didn't use the word slow the roll. Maybe
that was
our
like,
words.
that was the general theme. That was the vibe.
Patience. All right, let's get to the interview with that voting FOMC member who talked exclusively with our Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Michael McKee earlier today on Bloomberg Surveillance. It was a must listen to. I certainly was listening. Tom was too. Mike, Richmond Fed President Tom Barkin, remind everybody, voting member, hawkish, dovish, what does he tend to do?
He tends to be a centrist. It's funny because you were saying exclusive interview. It was an exclusive interview to us, but everybody from the Fed these days is basically saying slow your roll. They're trying to talk the markets down from this 5-6 rate cut idea, and they've sort of pushed out the Fed until May, but there's still that many different rate cuts priced in. We couldn't get Tom Barkin to commit to a number of rate cuts or a day for when they might cut or may. But his view was they need to be cautious because they don't want inflation to go back up again. They want to be certain that it's going to continue going down. After that, he said, the interesting question, and I'm paraphrasing here, is how far it goes down, because the economy is doing fine right now and we're at 5.5%. So how far do you have to lower rates? How far can you lower rates? I mean, what's the best thing to do? That's going to be their next tough decision.
Is the market listening to these members of the Federal Reserve? Are they taking note of what they're saying and responding accordingly?
Well, they're listening because every time one of them comes on the tape, the markets move. They change their forecasts, and in most cases, they reduce the odds of rate cuts, and then they come right back again when we get, as you pointed out, a strong if meaningless data point. And so,
Mike McKee's words. I don't know about meaningless.
Mike McKee's words, well, not ours.
Why is it meaningless?
Well, the jobless claim, it's a very high frequency indicator, and okay, the week to week changes don't mean all that much. Last week, we had a big rise. If we'd had another big rise this week, it might have meant a little more, because then you're keeping an eye out for a change in the trend. But it went back down, suggesting last week was just kind of noise.
What about continuing claims?
Continuing claims, you watch for the same reason, but they went down again, too.
Right.
And the thing that they're telling you is how easy it is to get a job, and it doesn't seem to have gotten any harder, which would be what you would be looking for. And to go back to what you were saying at the beginning, what Barkin was saying today is that companies are slowing their hiring, never mind what happened in January, but in general, companies are telling him they're slowing their hiring, but they are not letting people go.
I love that. He said, right, there is not as much hiring, not as much firing going on. I thought that was really crucial.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talked about this, I think, the last time I was on.
We did.
The
you
idea
did.
That we're seeing a lot of these notifications of tech companies letting people go, even if they're only a few hundred here, a few hundred there. But there's some that announced thousands of job cuts, but there's so much churn in the labor market that those really aren't that big. And what he's saying is, this is not, we're not seeing a widespread layoff problem. We're not seeing a recessionary labor market right now.
What are the numbers you'd have to see, Mike, in order for that to change?
Well, I think you'd be looking at a continual rise in the jobless claims numbers over 300,000 or more, a significant change in the direction there, a significant slowdown in net hiring, which is what the payrolls report is. The Fed has always said that you need about 100,000 jobs a month to remain stable in the labor market, not a soft or not a hard, tight labor market. And we're, well, we were at 353,000 last month, so we're a long way from anything like that.
Listen, when you talk with these Fed regional bank presidents, what's important is addressing stresses, right? And they keep a real watch on certainly any kind of financial strain or stress. Look at the banking system very closely. You guys got into regional bank worries.
We did. You, I think you have a little bit of a Tom Barkin soundbite on that.
Let's play it out for everybody.
You can feel the stress in the commercial real estate area, particularly, of course, downtown office. So that's a real thing. And the banks, many banks and non-banks have exposure. It wouldn't stun me if, you know, a bank or two ended up wrong footed in those things. But the system knows that real estate is a, you know, asset with a certain amount of risk. And I hope and expect that, you know, we've got enough capital to weather that.
That, of course, is Richmond Fed President Tom Barkin. I hope and expect that, you know, we've got enough capital to weather that. Is that reassuring? Enough reassuring?
That's a good question. I hope. I mean, they should know a little bit about it. He did go on to point out that they've done a lot of stress testing on this, and they're working with the banks on a regular basis. So I think from his point of view, they have enough, but they don't know what the depth of any problems could be. So that's where the hope comes in. Mm-hmm. But he seemed relatively confident, as others do, that at this point, there are the regulators, not just the Fed, but the OCC and the FDIC, are as on top of it as they can be. The question is what happens then going forward. How bad do things get? One question I really wanted to ask him and I did not get a chance to is, and this is something maybe you guys can ask experts that you talk to about these things. NYCB was a... The problem there was a huge drop in the stock price because investors got worried about the losses they had on their loan books. But the regulators don't think it's a huge problem because they can raise capital and they can come back. Mm-hmm. But could an investor run lead to a customer run?
That's a great point.
And if investors lose confidence, then do people... the ordinary person on the street lose confidence.
We haven't
confidence.
Seen that with New York Community Bank yet.
Well, there's a reason for that, which I did not know until today. I just found out this today. In the last year, because they were trying to diversify and grow, NYCB not only took on the Signature Bank bad loan portfolio that is causing them problems now, they also bought Flagstar Bank, which was a healthy, normal deposit-taking bank. And when they did that, they moved most of their deposit activity to Flagstar. Had you heard Flagstar in connection with NYCB?
Yeah.
So whatever's happening to NYCB, Flagstar's fine. People did not know that Flagstar is their deposit-taking institution, so there's no reason for them to worry. And there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with Flagstar, so it seems to be okay.
Hey, Mike, 10 seconds on CPI tomorrow. What are we expecting?
Well, we're looking for revisions to CPI tomorrow. Last year, the revisions to the seasonal adjustments pushed the level of inflation down at the beginning of the year, but at the end of the year, it raised it. Mm-hmm. And so Chris Waller from the Fed said, this is going to be really important tomorrow to see if we have that. It was an unusual thing, doesn't usually happen. They normally have very small movements, but they are going to be very interested to see what happens tomorrow with the revisions.
All right, we'll keep a watch on it. Mike, thank you as always. Michael McKee, of course, and check out his interview, full interview with Tom Barkin of the Richmond Fed. You can find it on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, you know, the big game is this weekend. We're talking, of course, about the 58th Super Bowl between the Kansas City Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers. The game held in the gambling capital of the United States, Las Vegas. Betting companies pushing out lots of ads ahead of the game, including this one from BetMGM.
BetMGM is for everyone that loves sports betting. Everyone. But Tom Brady.
Wait, what did I do?
The truth is you've won too much, Tommy. Let others have their turn.
What if I bet in-game parlays and I'm not Tom Brady?
You're it. Now dog me.
All right, well, MGM is for everyone that loves sports betting. Everyone but Tom Brady. Wait, what did I do here? All right, the truth is you want too much. It's just funny, like, to just kind of go through what they said. These are, though, the ads that we're seeing roll out ahead of it.
I mean, it makes sense that we're seeing these ads because big money is expected to trade hands this year. According to the Gambling Industry National Trade Association, about 26% of American adults are expected to place a wager on the Super Bowl. It's a 35% increase from last year's Super Bowl. Bettors are estimated to place wagers totaling up to $23.1 billion, which is a $7 billion increase from 2023. We've got with us Adam Greenblatt. He's the CEO of BetMGM, joining us now from Las Vegas. BetMGM is the sports betting operator jointly owned by MGM Resorts and the Isle of Man-based gambling company Entain. Adam, good to have you. Good to see you. Give us an idea of what you're seeing on BetMGM's platform right now ahead of the Super Bowl this weekend.
Well, firstly, thank you for having me. We are seeing interest that we've never seen before. Cross-section of wagers, we're seeing the growth in prop bets. We're seeing the Swift effect. We are seeing, yeah, as I say, a lot of interest. I think also because the event is taking place in Vegas, which really is home turf for us.
So Swift effect, does that mean more women are stepping up and betting on the platform?
Well, actually, we're seeing it's what we're noticing is the nature of the bets that are being sought out has changed. So, for example, we now offer in Ontario, we now offer the likelihood of Taylor Swift being mentioned in the MVP speech. And that's an interestingly popular bet. We're also seeing a lot of support for Travis Kelce's MVP. And I think that's how the Swift effect is manifesting.
Well, that's what I wonder too, Adam, is the kinds of bets that are being placed, the majority of bets that are being placed ahead of the big game, is it basically who wins ultimately? Or give us some idea, because you really can now dice and slice in terms of how you bet on anything.
So just to set the context, BetMGM will be offering more than 1,000 different things to bet on come game day. In fact, the majority are available now. Historically, the majority of bets and majority of volume were behind what we call the six-pack, which is really the bet for and against who will win the game, the money line, spread, so by what margin will the winner win, and total, the total points. What we're seeing now is a shift. So 62% of bets are not on that. So more than half the bets are on things called player props. The most popular player prop at the moment is a win that the Chiefs will win by 7 to 12 points.
Okay. Hey, Adam, is this the way that you differentiate yourself from the competitors out there? Because there is no shortage of places to make bets, especially for the Super Bowl. I mean, we got DraftKings, we got FanDuel, we got Caesars. The list certainly goes on. How do you differentiate yourself in a crowded market?
Well, look, the market's been crowded since the beginning. And I think we have, BetMGM's proven that we know what it takes to win. And we continue to be a market leader. We have 17% market share in online sports betting and iGaming across North America. And so this puts us firmly in the top tier of competitors. And one of the things that is particularly in our favor this year is that the two leaders that we share the podium with are actually not available in the state of Nevada because of regulation. So this really is our moment to shine. BetMGM's on home turf, leaning into what we call our omni-channel strategy. And given that we are by far and away the premier choice in town, we're expecting to see tremendous volume.
All right, but how would you characterize, Adam, the level of promotional competition in the online sports betting industry now compared to a year ago? It's got to be somewhat fierce, but tell us how you would characterize it.
Well, it's interesting. That's what we're actually seeing. And I'm not sure whether it's as a result of some of the minnows, some of the smaller players actually leaving the market because the power and effectiveness of the leaders has become overwhelming. But we're actually seeing a rational recruitment environment. Our CPAs, a cost to acquire a player, are actually down year on year over the last few weeks.
Hey, I'm wondering about growth here because you're live right now in 28 different markets in North America. You mentioned the market share. You have access to just under half of the adult population in North America. When is a time that you think you will have access to every adult in North America?
Well, that's an important question because that's about the, you know, when does the music stop? And the good news is the music is not going to stop for a while. Our TAM, our total addressable market, anticipates that in the fullness of time, and there's a question mark on, you know, what that means, of course, but in the fullness of time, we expect fully 80% of the U.S. adult population to have access to some form of sports betting.
What do you think are the next two states to legalize or markets set to legalize over the next 1 or 2 years?
Well, the first one I can answer with authority, because we're looking forward to launching in the state of North Carolina in the next 4 weeks.
Okay.
After that, it's less certain. We're seeing some positive movements from a number of states. I think the most likely next one, as we look at it today, is the state of Georgia. But ultimately, these become legislative decisions and subject to all the vagaries that go along with those.
Would you say that the space is getting a bit crowded and that we're going to see some kind of additional, maybe consolidation or more consolidation?
I don't know that I think you're referring to a couple of the more recognized brands that have joined the space recently. I think there's probably space for 3 or 4, maybe 5. If we look at more mature international markets, perhaps the UK, Italy, the bigger markets, there's generally space for 4 or 5 leading major online players. In the US, it is more concentrated, actually. To your question, is there space for consolidation? Potentially. But one of the factors weighing against consolidation in the US particularly is just the complexity of the operating environment, given that every state is its own regulated environment. So, you know, for a merger in the US, it's like a European operator that operates in all of the European countries merging with another.
Hey, Adam,
and then figuring out the regulation that goes along with it.
That's true.
We only have about 20 seconds left, but are you looking to make any acquisitions?
Gosh, straight for it. We're very, very happy with the tools, the assets, the relationships that we have. We believe we have what it takes to win, so we're not considering actively any acquisitions at this point.
All right, 20 seconds. So important that in terms of we talk about sports addiction, gambling addiction, you guys are thinking about that. And just really quickly, about 10 seconds here.
This is a real issue. This is an issue of sustainability of our sector. We're making great strides individually as BetMGM, but also in 2024, we will see collective action in this regard.
Adam, thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Come on, Barbie, let's go party.
All right, folks, we are talking about the home of Barbie and so much more. Mattel, the stock bouncing around today, up as high as nearly 3%, lower fractionally as we speak, actually pretty flat now. The home of Barbie, Hot Wheels, and as we said, so much more. Reported sales as well as adjusted earnings per share for the fourth quarter did miss the average analyst estimate, but adjusted gross margin for the year, it did beat the analyst estimate.
Yeah, sales were up 16% in the fourth quarter. Let's get to it with Ynon Kreiz, chairman and CEO of Mattel. He joins us from El Segundo, California. Ynon, good to see you. I got to tell you, sometimes when we interview you, I just expect like Will Ferrell to show up right there, and it's not Ynon Kreiz, but we are happy to see you this afternoon. How are you doing? How is, you know, we heard from you guys yesterday, stock bouncing around a little bit. Sales were up, but a couple things did not come in line with analyst estimates. How are you thinking about the quarter and in the year?
Well, thank you for inviting me again. It's always good to be here with you. It was a very strong fourth quarter for Mattel, with double-digit growth in top and bottom line, with significant margin expansion. The year as a whole was a milestone year for the company. In addition to the incredible success of the Barbie movie, which we could not be more proud of, we extended our leadership in key toy categories and gained significant share overall, and continued to strengthen our financial position. You know, we talked on the call about the fact that we generated over $700 million of free cash flow, more than 2.5 times of last year. We achieved an investment grade rating in the year. Our balance sheet is in the strongest we've had in years. And we just announced a $1 billion share repurchase program and believe we're in an excellent position to continue to execute our strategy.
So what else do you do with that strong cash flow and all that money? Where else do you want to invest it? Investors love when you give it back, but where else can you kind of invest it back in the business?
Well, in terms of capital allocation priorities, the number one area that we focus on is organic growth. And we're looking to continue to invest in areas that can create value and position the company for long-term, sustainable, profitable growth. We also look to maintain our investment grade rating and keep our leverage ratio between 2 to 2.5 times. Debt to EBITDA. And of course, there are M&A opportunities that we're looking to look at and consider. We'll be very disciplined. We will make sure that whatever we do is thoughtful, strategic, and accretive to the company, and continue to be in line with our strategy for value creation.
All right, Ynon, you know us well. You say M&A opportunities, our ears perk up. So what might be some of those M&A opportunities? How are you thinking about it? Because who would have thunk maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that you guys would be creating content and creating a movie that was the highest in terms of gross billings for 2023? So here you are. So when you think about M&A opportunities, where do you go? Or where should we be thinking when it comes to you guys?
Well, we can't be too early to be specific about opportunities.
Well, you could,
but too early. But as I said, you know, we have been very disciplined in the way we manage our balance sheet over the years, and we remain very thoughtful and very strategic about any choice that we might make when it comes to capital deployment and on M&A opportunities. That said, we have the capital, we have the strength, we have a very strong platform that is scalable, and we would look for opportunities that would accelerate our strategy without putting the company under any risk, and make sure that it's accretive and strategic to the direction where we're heading.
If we can follow, though, is it more akin to an acquisition that gives you another toy to play with and build content off of it? Or is it more on the content creation side that you guys, in terms of M&A opportunities, Enon, might be most interested in?
Too early to be specific. And it's not to say that we don't have exciting organic opportunities. You know, we have a portfolio that proven itself within the toy side. And of course, now we have template and showcase for what we can do outside of the toy aisle. And, you know, some of the important takeaways from the year was how our brands resonate outside of the toy aisle. And that is a key part of our strategy to be successful within the toy part of the company and continue to evolve and grow in entertainment, other verticals that are highly accretive and adjacent to the toy industry, but where we can create value from organic growth.
Hey, Enon, I want to talk a little bit about the 2024 outlook. We learned from you yesterday, and I think that some might say it's a little conservative because it calls for a third straight year of flat sales growth. How conservative are you being here?
Well, we do expect the industry to be down in the year. And in that context, we expect to gain share and be ahead of the industry and continue the momentum that we have already with very strong market share gain in 2023. Our priority for 2024 is on growth in profitability, expanding our growth margin, and generate strong cash flow. And this is something we've done successfully in 2023. We believe that we will grow in 2025, both top and bottom line. And with the strong market share gain and overall strong performance, broad-based performance within the toy industry, we see multiple drivers that will continue to put the company on the front foot as we execute our strategy.
You know, and I think, though, you know, we're all wondering, you know, you guys do get a great vantage point when it comes to the consumer. I think a lot of us would say if we want to, you know, get something for one of our kids, like that is a priority. So in terms of consumer and consumption spending, what are you seeing? How would you describe the consumer from your perspective?
Well, the what we saw in 2023 is a shift in consumer spending towards experiences and services, and we see it moderating. It will continue to moderate in 2024, and beyond 24, we believe that those trends will further improve, and that the industry will return to growth and continue to grow over the long term. The toy industry as a whole has very strong fundamentals. It's an important part of consumers' lives. It's a fundamental core human behavior. The toy aisle is a strategic lever for retailers. Mm-hmm. It's experiential, it drives foot traffic, items are affordable, and especially when it comes to quality product and trusted brands, parents will always prioritize spending money on their children and cut on other things rather than quality toys for their children.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking right now to Enon Kreiz, Chairman and CEO of Mattel, joining us from El Segundo, California. Enon, I want to talk about specific brands and segments within Mattel's portfolio, specifically Fisher-Price. The brand had a great fourth quarter. Do you believe you can extend the momentum here? Do you expect to gain share when it comes to infant, toddler, and preschool market this year?
Yes, Fisher-Price did have a great quarter. It was up double digit. It was number one in the category and gained more share for the full year. Within Fisher-Price, Little People performed particularly strongly and expanded into adult collector line with some great product for the Super Bowl. So look out for
that.
Okay, what about when it comes to Hot Wheels?
Wait, go ahead. How much demand is there? Give us an idea.
No, as you can imagine, of course, it's in high demand, and Little People is such a great brand, and this is where we touch culture. This is our expertise and something we do so well. You have a product that is evergreen, but here, you know, we have moments and opportunities to mm-hmm. touch societal moments like the Super Bowl and create a special offering for that.
Is there a Taylor Swift, Little People? That's what we want to know.
Anything is possible to little people. Watch that space.
All I know is my daughter likes to eat the little people, okay? What about Hot Wheels? Because it reached just $1.6 billion in gross billing for 2023, surpassing Barbie. Do you see Hot Wheels staying the number one brand for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, Hot Wheels is such an incredible brand. It's a huge canvas of ideas and innovation and product and opportunities. Hot Wheels was up 16% in the quarter. For the full year, it was, 16% for the full year. And it was the sixth consecutive record year for the brand after over 50 years of existence. So it's been on a real, real growth momentum. We gained almost 300 basis points in the category. We have by far the largest market share on record. And Hot Wheels continues to be the number one brand globally in vehicles per Circana. In 24, we expect our vehicles category to grow, driven by Hot Wheels, and Hot Wheels will grow yet again, seven consecutive record year for the brand. And don't forget that we have a movie in development with J.J. Abrams at Warner Brothers for Hot Wheels, and another movie, a Matchbox movie with Skydance that produced Mission Impossible and Top Gun. So two of the most successful filmmakers in Hollywood are working on two very exciting brands as part of our vehicles portfolio.
How profitable is that area becoming for you? You know, we talk about Barbie, highest grossing film of 2023 generating, and I hope I have this number right, something like $1.4 billion or so, give or take a little bit. What ultimately was the impact on Mattel's bottom line as a result of that movie? I'm just curious.
Yes, we were happy to share that the Barbie movie generated for Mattel in 2023, just 2023, $150 million of revenue and about $90 million of operating income directly related to the movie. This is box office plus toys and consumer product directly associated with the movie. So this is one brand, one movie, in 1 year. And the reason we share that is to illustrate the potential that we can generate out of our growing entertainment business.
Right.
And while we're not saying that every movie will be the next Barbie, in the aggregate, this could become a meaningful part of our business. Our entertainment offering that includes film, television, live events, consumer product and merchandise, digital, music, location-based entertainment in the aggregate across our portfolio can be an important business for Mattel. And clearly, we are on that path to capture that value. And the Barbie movie is really a showcase or a template to illustrate that.
Well, it's a success story, right? I've got to imagine, you know, you talked about a couple of movies already based on Mattel products, toys, if you will, intellectual property, whatever you want to call it. But I do wonder how many people were knocking on your door after the success of Barbie, where many would probably have thought it never could happen, and it did. Are a lot of studios, streaming, and what have you, knocking on your door about future collaborations?
Well, you can imagine what the movie did in terms of showing that our brands resonate outside of the toy aisle. And this was something that was not obvious before, and clearly the Barbie movie showed that with the right creative vision, with when you work with the best filmmakers in the world, like Greta Gerwig or Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, great things happen. And perhaps the biggest evolution for us as a company was to realize that people who buy our product are not just consumers, they are fans.
Right.
And in the aggregate, fans become an audience. And that's when you realize that you're actually speaking to an audience, that's when opportunities open up and you can capture and create significant value in other verticals.
Hey, listen, 20 seconds less, 25. Is it going to be a Barbie 2? Does Alan get a movie? Does Ken get a movie? You can make news right here with us. Just got about 25 seconds.
You know, we always said we're looking to create and build and develop film franchises. We're not talking specifically about Barbie, but we have an incredible portfolio and we're looking to continue to excite and delight fans all over the world.
I'm just going to say, Barbie's a doctor, an astronaut, president. She can be a tentpole, you know, in terms of
Carol loved the movie, franchise. In case you didn't know that by now. I think it's the second quarter in a row we've interviewed you, Enon, and she's talked about how much she loves
the movie. I bought
Barbie,
Barbie merchandise.
You're not alone, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Totally
thank
transparent.
You, thank you.
Enon, always be well. Appreciate it. Enon Krais, he's Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Mattel, joining us on Zoom from El Segundo, California. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
What I really think is interesting is the technical chart on ARM today. We talk rallies, and then there are rallies like what we are seeing in ARM holding today. Chip designer ARM holding surging more than 64% today at its high, to a record, and Tim up the most since its IPO last September.
ARM issued a surprisingly bullish earnings forecast showing its push beyond smartphones is helping fuel growth. We knew that we had to go back to it after talking about it late yesterday following ARM earnings and getting an update. So we've got a great roundtable. With us are Ian King, Bloomberg News U.S. semiconductor and networking reporter. Also, Kunjan Sobhani, senior semiconductor analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, both joining us from San Francisco this afternoon. Ian, I want to start with you. We were all over this yesterday. So were you when the company reported these blowout numbers. The dust has settled somewhat, but I want to start big picture here. Remind us, remind our viewers, what exactly ARM does and how it differentiates itself from everyone else who's in the space.
Yeah, they're kind of in that sort of middleware space. I mean, they license what's called an instruction set. These are the basic pieces of software that chips and software use to talk to each other, and that goes into everything. And they also license parts of chip designs, which all manner of companies use, Amazon, Apple, and lots of other companies kind of sign up and design their own chips based on these portions that ARM sell them. That said, ARM, though, is obviously increasing its scope and moving closer to becoming a company like Qualcomm.
And Kunjan, is that what it's all about? This, you know, how do you justify this hockey stick move that we are seeing in ARM holdings today, up 64% at its highs, now up about 50%? Is it because it's becoming more like a Qualcomm? It's moving out beyond just what has been its bread and butter?
I mean, look, there were definitely a lot of positives in the earnings, so I don't want to take anything away from it. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me a key driver of this kind of a pop has to be coming from a combination of fear of missing out and the search for the next true AI semiconductor name beyond NVIDIA and AMD, which can generate revenues starting now this year rather than a promise of future. So I think the earnings highlighted a couple of things which investors now feel comfortable that ARM can definitely monetize and take a bite of this AI spending frenzy starting now.
What were a couple of those things that it highlighted, Kunjan?
Yeah, so there one is their rising penetration of their V9 architecture. It is definitely right now a lot more in smartphones, especially with the launches of Android flagship phones like Galaxy S24, which are touting AI features. So as that penetration continues to rise, they get, for every V9, they get 2x ASP uplift compared to a V8. And more than that, it was also their wins in outside of smartphones, in data centers and automotive. Look, they are now in the NVIDIA Grace Hopper chip, right? An Amazon chip, Microsoft chip. And I think they are definitely in talks with engagement with other large hyperscalers. So each of those design wins gives them a significantly higher royalty rate than what a smartphone design win does.
You know, I always think about, you know, what this means, and I know we talk about this a lot with you, Ian, in terms of what it says more broadly. Is this really a very company-specific story, or is it more, indicative of some of the broader trends that are happening in the chip industry?
I think a mixture of both, and obviously we addressed the company-specific side of it yesterday. But I think, to Kunjan's point, what people have been looking for here, because we've heard Qualcomm say it, we've heard Intel say it, we've heard lots of companies say, hey, AI chips aren't just about NVIDIA accelerators, they're about all kinds of things, you know, smartphones, cars, whatever it is, they're going to need more computing in order to be able to get AI to work. And everybody's saying that, but nobody's proved it in the numbers yet. Have we heard about the AI PC? But, you know, have we seen a big hit from? No, we haven't. Yeah. This is probably the first company to sort of show any real progress in that front.
So Ian, talk to us a little bit about where where we think it's going or where you think the industry is going? Because part of the theme of this report was that it is moving beyond smartphones. So talk to us about the other products that, you know, we see this show up and where you think investors are the most bullish.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke with the CEO this morning, as you know, and he said, look, I'm in Teslas, I'm in the Ford F-150, I'm in smart home devices, I'm in your Samsung TV. I think the answer to your question is, we don't know yet, right? Yeah. The device you carry around with you all the time is obviously the smartphone. Put more intelligence in that and it becomes a platform for all kinds of things. And we've seen that historically be the case. That is the obvious candidate. But again, we haven't seen that yet. We've seen that talked about. But if history is a guide, it's always the unlooked for thing. And a company like Arm, a company like Qualcomm or Broadcom, they're creating what they call as a platform, which is basically saying to the world, hey, we're giving you these capabilities, now go out and find a use for them.
Mm-hmm. Kunjan, same question to you. I mean, when Ian's talking, it makes me think of something like the Apple Vision Pro headset. I still haven't seen someone walking around with it in the real world. But is that the type of device that investors are optimistic Arm can play in?
Well, that's the ultimate promise that everyone's trying to sell. But going back to the point, right, not all companies are able to show that in the numbers. So as of right now, what Arm is able to show it is in data center, the core use of AI, generative AI, and in automotive, where we see a lot more silicon and AI adoption. So that's where that's sort of the next immediate end markets and use cases, and followed by smartphones and the promise of AI PC.
You know, one of the other names I wanted to roll into this, guys, is something else I saw, Monolithic Power. It's another name, a semiconductor device company. It also is out with fourth quarter results that beat expectations, positive outlook. Analysts noted a tailwind from AI. And we saw this one. I know it's among some of my gainers that I'm keeping an eye on today. Let me just pull it up on the Bloomberg. But you're looking at a 14% gain. Ian, is this another name on your radar by any chance?
I mean, the power semiconductor sector of the industry, I mean, they're relatively small. They're mm-hmm. not particularly expensive products, but that's been something that people have been sort of excited about as it pertains to automotive. Basically, you have more EVs, then you need more ability to convert power into various different voltages and distribute power effectively in a complex electronic system. And that's where companies like Monolithic come in. And we've seen other companies kind of ride that wave as well. The argument that extends beyond EVs is, well, if we're going to have more and more smart devices out there in the world, then getting that battery power out of the battery and into all of these different components is going to become more important. So we're going to need more of this type of chip.
I am curious, you know, when I talk to two individuals like yourself, and Kunjan, come on back in this, you know, what is it that you think about most? What companies kind of occupy, you know, your brain space the most, and why?
Yeah, so on the AI side, you know, we think the top contenders right now are definitely NVIDIA and AMD. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, Arm and Broadcom, and to some extent Marvell, these would be sort of the top five names that I can think of who can immediately start monetizing a portion of this AI chip spend.
Same to you, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, Kunjan just gave you the right answers, right? Mm-hmm. He just scored 100% on the test. What I think
well
interests
done.
Me is can the Empire strike back here? Can mm-hmm. Intel parlay what it's supposedly capable of doing, what it's planning to do, into a dominant position? Again, it's trying, it's saying all the right things, it's got all of the things in place, but we haven't seen the kind of progress I think that we would want to see to this point. That, to me, is the big story and the fascinating one of can they or can't they.
Ian, very quickly, we have 20 seconds. Are any analysts out there saying today's move is not warranted for Arm?
Bernstein have been very careful, shall we say, or cautious on their approach, and they reluctantly went out there and said, well, you have to hand it to them, this is pretty good, but you know, there's always a naysayer, right? There's always somebody betting the other way.
So it makes a market.
I was just going to say that.
All right, guys, listen, thank you so much. So appreciate it. Ian King, U.S. Semiconductor Networking Reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us from San Francisco. Kujan Sabani, Senior Semiconductor Analyst, also out there in San Francisco. He's, of course, a member of our Bloomberg Intelligence team. But ARM, again, on a tear up about 49-50% off its highs, but nonetheless on a tear on this Thursday.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, as you know, you've been listening to Charlie Pellett. I mean, we got so close to 5,000 on the Dow, 4,999.37. So right now we're off of that, but we got pretty close.
We got 4,999.37?
4,999.37, yeah.
We'll see if we'll get there today.
We're at a record, though, right?
Yeah, we're at a record, but we're not at 5,000.
No, we're not at 5,000. Up we go, up we go. I'm just looking at where we are for the year. The Dow is up almost 4.8%.
Okay.
On this February 8th.
Okay, so we're there.
6 weeks, 7 weeks in.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing.
Yeah.
What does the rest of the year look like? Hey, we got a great guest to ask that question to. Cheryl Pate is Senior Portfolio Manager at Angel Oak Capital. She joins us on Zoom from Atlanta. Cheryl, good to have you with us. It's been a few months since we spoke. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back on.
How does the rest of the year look like, given that we have made such big gains in such a short period of time?
Yeah, I think a lot does depend on how we're moving through the economic cycle here. And I think we've been encouraged by a lot of the data that has come out of late. We have been in the camp of expecting a soft landing and looking for the first rate cut to come in June, but moderate cuts, you know, over the course of the second half of the year. So I think we've been encouraged by the balance between employment and inflation where we are today, and look for that to sort of continue to move in an orderly fashion, which I do think supports continued growth in the equity markets.
You are portfolio manager for the Financials Income Fund, Financial Strategies Income Term Trust, the Dynamic Financial Strategies Income Term Trust. Where are the flows? Where are the flows coming in? Where are the flows going out?
Yeah, it's definitely has not been quiet in the financial sector last year and this year alike. So it's been, I think, a lot of conversations. There's clearly some dislocated markets, both on the equity and fixed income side in banks in particular. But what we're really seeing is dislocation creates opportunities. And I think there's a lot to parse through the big banks versus the regional banks versus the community banks and where the relative value lies there. We're particularly more bullish on the large cap banks, more diversification, more of a skew to consumer. We like the community banks as well, relationship driven, strong franchises. And I think we're much more cautious on the regional banks, given regulatory costs increasing, given commercial real estate concerns.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see some of that play out.
Okay, give me the distinction between community banks and regional banks, please.
Yeah, when we look at the sector overall, I would say community banks are sort of that $50 billion and below in asset size, really localized to a specific geography, whereas regional banks, you know, kind of go up to that $250, $300 billion kind of mark and have grown across different geographies in different asset classes and have a little bit less of a relationship focus, more of a commercial real estate exposure as well, typically.
How much are you kind of marking time a little bit in terms of maybe moving some things around in your portfolios just because you want a little bit more clarity on what the Fed next does? Everybody's widely expecting it's going to be a rate cut. It's just kind of when and how much. But, you know, I'm just curious how you see it and kind of how you hold off before making any kind of really decisive bets for the rest of the year waiting for the Fed.
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple things that we're always looking at, net interest margin trends, and we have been looking for pressures to abate there, particularly as you move closer to a rate cut environment. But I think one thing we've been encouraged by is the fact that fourth quarter earnings, I think, actually showed better trends than anticipated in sort of calling the bottom on NIM compression and actually seeing some expansion in some cases. So that's something we look at. We're also very closely monitoring things like consumer delinquencies, where we think we've hit sort of peak deterioration and, you know, the bar is moving to a more positive and constructive view there. So I think, you know, willing to put money to work on the larger cap side and sort of placeholder on some of the, you know, longer tailed stories from here.
Got a favorite couple of names? I think BAC and JPM are some of those that you look to outperform. Talk to us
about
that.
Both. On the large cap side, I think, you know, we always look for stories that have really good deposit franchises. There's a lot of value to those deposits in the rate environment we're in today. We look at excess capital as a driver of value and then diversification. I think you've also got sort of fortress balance sheets, particularly at JP Morgan, which I think is increasingly critical in today's environment where there's a lot of fear in the market and a lot of volatility coming into the equity prices.
Are you concerned about anything out there? Like, are cracks starting to show when you think about the consumer or the macroeconomic environment?
I would say I think we've been pleasantly surprised at how well the consumer is holding in. And given where we're seeing credit card and auto delinquency trends, we feel probably better about the consumer side of things. We are, I think, starting to see some cracks in commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a surprise. It's been a known concern for some time. And you are starting to see some delinquencies tick up. Clearly, we've been seeing reserves building for some time. But I think the next couple of quarters, we're going to start to see more deterioration, particularly in office. And that's one area that we're paying particular attention to.
Listen, this is your world, even though you may not, you know, you're not keen on the regionals at this point, but you do certainly keep a watch on it. Do you see among the conversations you're having as you just, you know, within the financial space and the banking space overall, anyone talking about crisis when it comes to regional banks?
No, I think the conversations overall have been that this, and we're talking about New York Community Bank specifically, mm-hmm. clearly, that this is not another regional banking crisis. I think this is very different from what we experienced last March, which was more liquidity driven. I think what you've got here with New York Community Bank is more of an idiosyncratic event, which is driven by the acquisition of Signature, bumping them into a Category 4 and the additional requirements that come along with that, as well as some cracks in commercial real estate in the New York market. So I think there's a couple things of play there. And I would say conversations that we're having with our investors would support that the view is not that this is another start of a crisis. But we do think there will be headline risk and there could be some, you know, specific names that have some sort of event
what related names, to just very briefly, what names?
Well, so New York Community obviously, you know, has a lot of commercial real estate in the New York office. I would say, you know, other ones that skew relatively high on concentration versus reserve ratio, which is one way we look at it, would be someone like Bank OZK and Valley tend to skew a little bit more commercial real estate. So not that we're necessarily concerned, but I think that does require additional scrutiny into the details of portfolios in this environment.
Bank OZK, by the way, up about 1% in today's trade. New York Community Bancorp, though, down another 6%. It rallied about 6% yesterday, but losing some ground today. Cheryl Pate, Senior Portfolio Manager at Angel Oak Capital, on Zoom from Atlanta. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.